Welcome, welcome, welcome. How's everybody doing? Hope you are doing well. My name is Andrew Kuhn with Focus Compounding, on air live with Jeff Gannon. Jeff, how's it going today?
It's going very well, Andrew. How's it going with you?
It's going great. We hope it's going great with everybody else as well. This is the first time you were tuning in with us. Thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to check out all of our content that we push out into the investing universe. The best way to do that is to follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Focused Compound. If you want to get access to our investment write-ups going all the way back to 2005, go to focuscompounding.com and you can get all of that for free at our website. All the information is in the description below. So in today's podcast, Jeff, we are going to be talking about a few different things. And before we do that, you had sent to me the Substack that you really like. We actually went over this recently. TofCap is a Substack, and they put out a monitor every single week where they talk about things that are happening in the event-driven world. And they are still, it's a free resource that's incredible. They are going to change their format to a PDF monitor like so. If you're watching here on the screen, I would say when you sent me this, I was like, oh, this is kind of perfect. Exactly what Jeff would like. Just something that's in one file, just all there, and just has a bunch of different things going on. It's a lot of work that they put into this monitor where they don't charge for it now.
So what's the address that we have there? They just put in TofCap and Substack?
Yeah, TofCap.substack.com. I'll put the link in
there. So it literally is called TofCap, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, uh-huh. And they keep up to date with event-driven situations, spinoffs, strategic alternatives, asset sales, M&A, stocks emerging from bankruptcy, stocks going into bankruptcy, insider buys, buybacks, all of that good stuff. And they're switching their format over to a PDF file, and it's a good, I guess it's a good resource that I wanted to shout out and tell everyone that they should definitely use this if they're not using it already. Spinoffs, yeah, Jeff, is the first things.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Do you have any thoughts or anything on this? I just cut you off.
No, I like the... Look, it's done by humans, so it isn't literally everything that anyone's announced, whether it's really going to happen or not. It is meant to be more interesting situations and just cataloging them, right? And so I think that that is better than some other ways that people could look for something, because people want basically a screen that's very mechanical all the time for things, and you have to be careful. Now, there are other sites that do that that are really good, but you have to learn a little bit about how to use them. So like Inside Arbitrage has a great thing with like buybacks and whether it's done in the quarter or the year, right? And then you sort through and look for it yourself. However, some of those are really interesting and some of those are really not interesting, and you have to know the reason for it. And so you have to then manually do it yourself after that, which is great because it casts a wider net, so you're not going to miss anything, which I like. I always have that problem when people recommend screens. I think what they want, actually, when they say what's a good screen, is they want something like TofCap. They don't actually want a screen which you do yourself, and then you weed out all the things that really is noise that somehow got in there, which is my preferred way of doing it, to not miss those things and then to have that. But then I can't, the things that I like as a mechanical screen are not the things that I think would work for other people, because I think they want a list of interesting situations that have been screened by humans to give you that, which can miss some things because they don't know everything and they will miss some things. But they want more of a curated list rather than the widest possible net.
Matthews International. So that's a stock, a business that we had just spoken about in the last podcast. And you were saying that they are spinning off some stuff. And I was like, does he follow this company? It seems kind of random that he knows that. I guess now I know why, right? Company working to enhance market value. And it sounds like might IPO/spin the energy solutions business or the entire industrial technology business in 2024, unlocking significant sum of the parts value.
I actually have historically followed Matthews a little. I really liked it as a business and stuff 20 some years ago or something. It has a situation similar to, not to get too much into this stuff, but like Hanes Brands, where people ask me about, was a spinoff that I liked and then hadn't talked about the company for a while. Different managers over time and different directions the company wanted to go in weren't always things that I liked, but I was interested in some of the core business and stuff. So followed a little bit, but like they do a lot of cap allocation and other things that maybe I don't like the direction that they've been going in for a long time, and they've become a different kind of company from what interested me originally. So when I hear that from this, that reminds me of the fact of how much I looked at the company and why I stopped reading their annual reports and stuff. The same thing would be true with Hanes Brands or something, which the only thing I know about Hanes Brands going on right now is they're allegedly, there's a possibility they might sell something and rumors about that and stuff. But that's one where people can see that when it spun off, what was it, 20 years ago or something, I was interested in the company when I first did that. But then I haven't liked the direction the company's headed in the last 10 to 15 years or something, with a lot of debt and acquisitions and all that. So it is good to sometimes follow companies like that, because those to me are more interesting than some of these, which are basically businesses I'm not interested in. I would like to find a business that I'm interested in, products that I'm interested in, and then see some event driven stuff on it. That's much more easier for me to go in there and look at, you know.
You had mentioned Hanes Brands. Did you originally find out about that situation through the Toff Capital document? I have it right here. It says considering selling its champion brands, which I think that's been going on for a while, and strong rumors that it has received multiple bids. As a reminder, HBI is currently exploring strategic options.
That's the part that's, yeah, it's been exploring strategic options. Yeah. Hanes Brands, I wrote up, I wrote up something and then didn't publish it when it was spun off. And I talked about it a little bit on things where I was asked for like a stock and stuff when it was an original spinoff. But obviously, the stock has not done well over its entire corporate history now. But at one point, it was up, I don't know. It probably went up, you know, 5 to 8 times or something from its spinoff price originally over a 10-year period. And then it's since dropped all of that and more or something. Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Bad corporate decisions for the last, like, long time.
The debt that they put on it or what?
Honestly, I mean, I think at the time that the stock was doing the best is some of the worst things that they were doing, but it was working on Wall Street and stuff. So it's just one of those situations. Yeah, they were taking on debt to buy things that I think weren't as great, getting further and further away from the stuff that was pretty good. And, you know, now they have a lot of debt. And so there's a bit of a problem that way. And cash flow issues, the quality of the earnings deteriorated around the COVID time and stuff. One thing I always stressed about the company that people don't understand, a big barrier to entry and real risk with the company, is that a company like Hanes Brands or Fruit of the Loom or something carries an incredible amount of working capital in terms of just inventory and stuff. And there's no guarantee from the retailers that they have to buy it. And so you can have pretty major swings on that. So it's better to have a somewhat better like credit rating and stuff, or certainly at least people who are focused on making sure that they turn the inventory into cash. And you do want to keep an eye on that. So, but it can have a pretty good swing the other way when it comes out of it. If you're carrying too much inventory and stuff, this is not inventory that has a lot of obsolescence. They have some stuff in t-shirts and stuff that can fall into that a little bit, but in innerwear and everything, you know, virtually everything that is sellable in 2022 is also sellable in 2023 and 2024. It's not wild fashion swings in terms of women's bras and men's and boys' underwear and stuff, the kinds of things that their biggest categories in terms of their best brands. So it's not like if there's a fashion miss at, Hollister or Abercrombie or whatever, you know, they can't, it's what it in 2024, the stuff they were making in 2022 can't be sold. You know, it's out of style for a teen fashion thing, and it's useless.
Innovative Food, that's a microcap. It says microcap Innovative Food is exploring strategic alternatives regarding its e-commerce business. A lot of interesting stuff is going on here. It might be interesting to keep an eye out. Have you looked at that? Are there any other situations on here that you're keeping an eye on?
And there's lots of ones that I've looked at, sure. I mean, especially some of the bigger ones that everybody knows about. You know, some of them are things that people could imagine that I follow because of the industry or whatever. I mean, as you know, I don't like to talk around the podcast, but I do like to follow situations where, okay, maybe I didn't like what the management was doing or the direction the company was headed or whatever, but I do like the business. And maybe if things change with that, it's freed up from that, then suddenly some of those things could be unlocked and stuff. So there's just some companies I don't really touch because I don't like the management or whatever, and maybe if those change. But a lot of times, you know, it doesn't always end up going as far as you would hope in terms of when they just say strategic alternatives and stuff. Yeah.
So anyways, Toph Capp, Monday Monitor. I'll put the link in the description. It's a great resource that is free that everybody should definitely check out. No affiliation to us. We just use it and have been happy by the free resource. So let's go over Dataroma. I wanted to talk about Super Investors and the 10 top buys last quarter, which would have been the end of it was Q4 2023. And just see if there's anything interesting in here. I mean, it's crazy with markets being at all-time highs. It's kind of what you would expect. But top buys for Q4 2023, Microsoft, Alphabet, Amazon, Charter, Visa, Berkshire, Apple, GM, Bank of America, Danaher. How do you typically sift through these, Jeff? Is this kind of like, do you ever look at, I know you look at top eyes and what other people are doing and whatever, but is it more so just to kind of get an industry idea? What are your takeaways from here? Something that I thought was interesting that caught my eye was Taiwan Semiconductor has had a pretty good a bunch of buys, and also the returns have been pretty decent. It's up 34% year to date.
Not amazing Buffett, for a semiconductor company this year though.
No, not NVIDIA's compared to NVIDIA.
80 or 90%.
But the thing that was interesting to me, like my takeaway from this was thinking about, okay, Buffett sold Taiwan Semiconductor. Yes. Like when? Was that actually around the annual meeting last year? So May, June, July? I can't remember when he sold. Sometime around then. He sold Taiwan Semiconductor. And what was interesting to me was at the time that he sold, it was cheap. I think he knew it was cheap. He thought it was cheap. But it was his discipline and just not touching something that could go completely nuclear and bomb out on him, you know, and for him, it just had that catastrophic risk. That was a big takeaway for me, was that even though it was cheap and he thought he could make money, he sold because it fell in the category of having that cat risk.
Yeah. And I think he saw that as changing quite a lot, as I did from when he bought it, that the risk was low before and now it's high. And obviously the risk is high because lots of countries are now doing things to produce stuff themselves and everything. So everyone's planning for a day when you can't rely on Taiwan to produce it. So, you know, obviously geopolitical stuff, they've shifted their policy. There's no doubt about that. That doesn't mean it's not a great company and that it won't work out. But obviously it means that the risk went from, he saw it as a lot closer to zero to not that close to zero. Yeah, sometimes the things they sell can do really well. I mean, I think they all sold Micron, like, when it started to go up, not when it's now gone crazy. So, you know, the super investors are good at certain things, and you should look at them for the skills that they have. But just like any of us, they're very bad at other things. And so you probably shouldn't listen to us when we talk about certain stuff, because we don't know what we're talking about with those things. And most of these don't know what they're talking about, and they're talking about industry things and stuff like that. They didn't become these super investors. This is more heavily focused on value investors, people with higher longevity and stuff. Might know stuff about what's a really good business, and they might detect a shift in the capital allocation to something that's a lot more friendly to you and all those things. You know, those skills that Buffett or any of these people have. And so it depends on the person, but like some of them are pretty good at understanding the industry economics and what companies are in good positions and which ones aren't. Like a Glenn Greenberg or something is one that would be like that. A Buffett one is very good for detecting changes in capital allocation and a different focus in the company about creating value that way. Some of the others are more contrarian. Very few of them are good at calling industry turns and stuff. That's not something that value investors are good at. So they wouldn't be the right ones to find of whether you should be selling NVIDIA now or whether you should have been buying Micron before or whatever like that. Although someone like Pabrai or something might be better at that than, say, a Buffett or something, right? And so he would be the one to look at more for industries bottoming out or something. I think the list of the biggest buy things is not one of my favorites because of the way that the list is put together. I'd look at each individual specific investor when they come out. And then also I like the insider buys. So if you go down, yeah, you can find it there. But in general, they just have a list that they put up all the time, the different ones. And so it's interesting when I can see insiders buying in a stock that super investors are also in and why they do it. And if it's a big change from what they did before. So it's nice to have that matching up those things. The problem with this is that the vast, vast, vast majority of these stocks are really big and stuff for us. These people got famous by making a lot of money over a long period of time. And so unless they like closed funds to not have anything out, paid out money, started up their own things, whatever, they're based on having a really great long-term track record, which means they're probably managing like more money than is really economically best. You know, you eventually get to the Buffett type thing, which is the most extreme version, but you're managing many billions when maybe it would be better if you're managing hundreds of millions, because that's unavoidable. If you've created a record over decades, that's amazing. And that's where they chose people. Yeah.
Car Mart.
Yeah, Boston, Omaha. You see that? America's Car Mart? You know the situation there, right?
No, not recently. Is okay. Boston, Omaha involved?
No, but someone who's connected to Boston, Omaha is involved. He was also involved with like Nicholas, right? So he's in subprime things, yeah. So what you're seeing there is a 10% bigger owner, but we're recognized. So a lot of times I wouldn't register with people, but we, however, we're looking at this and I'm saying, look, I recognize the name as someone who's in other things. And so I've seen the filings on that and stuff. And yeah, he's been buying America's Car Mart. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for a long time though, right? I mean, I shouldn't say for a long time. Consistently, yeah. Yeah, America's Car Mart is cheap. It's a question of whether like things will turn around and it'll get better and everything, but it's extremely cheap. There's no doubt about that versus its receivables and stuff. But it's in the worst possible situation. I mean, I think even in Frost, not this quarter, but maybe last quarter, they said that their biggest charge-off was a buy here, pay here borrower of theirs. Or I shouldn't say charge-off. I don't remember if it's a charge-off or if they moved the loan, classified it without the, you know. But basically, that's true that people who are lending to these companies and stuff are seeing this as being the most distressed part of the market. You kind of, lots of things are happening, but you kind of borrow floating. It's not exactly what all of them do, but you take a part of your balance sheet, and America's Car Mart is pretty low compared to others, although they securitize some now. But before they would securitize them, they would be pretty low, maybe 30% or so of their balance sheet, but it would basically be floating short-term rates. So that'd be like, you know, imagine Fed funds plus some number or something. It's not literally Fed funds, it's an overnight rate that's similar to Fed funds. And then you have a much more capped rate that you're charging your customers, right? So you're basically borrowing at, say, 2% or 5% or whatever, plus a number, whatever the Fed funds is, but you're tending to lend at like 15 or whatever it is. Now, they also make a profit on it, so it's more complicated. Effectively, they're lending at like more than 15 if you think about how much they have a gross profit, whereas other lenders are basically selling you a car without profit and then making more on the loan, you know, so it's not completely comparable. But that's basically the way it works. And so they get squeezed on that. In addition, delinquencies aren't particularly low because inflation is a real problem for people in the lowest income brackets and things, and with especially people with who are sometimes unemployed, inconsistent employment, et cetera, who are their customers. And those people are hurt a lot by inflation. And those people obviously don't have assets, so they don't benefit from home prices going up and stock prices going up and all that. So you could imagine that America's Car Mart is hurting a lot, and their customers are really hurting from what's going on in the country with all those sorts of things, with inflation and with prices and all that. And then the length of the car loan is longer and stuff. So they've had changes in who's running the company. Over the last, I don't know, year and a half or something, they've moved some people from a few positions. So you can see that there's basically new people running it.
Is it cheap for cheap's sake, or is it cheap enough to, there's a good, you know, 3, 5, 10 year return from these levels? Meaning, like, how is that gap going to close?
Oh, well, I mean, if the loans perform and stuff, the gap will close. I mean, it doesn't even have to keep selling new cars. I mean, it's cheap versus a portfolio, even if the portfolio was just in runoff, if it was really collecting successfully. It doesn't need the lots and stuff. It could just sell off the inventory, close up shop, and eventually collect more money in runoff. That's actually what some of these lenders end up doing eventually, as they end up in runoff. So if you're saying, like, is it cheap as a portfolio? Yeah, you can see what the receivables are. Those receivables are usually marked down about 25% or so as a provision for losses. So you're seeing that if you go quarterly, what do you have as accounts receivable?
Accounts receivable. So we could just do, you know, the past year, $1 billion, 1.1, 1.1, and now it's just under 1.1 billion.
Yeah. So you just want it as a balance sheet item. That's loans that they have. So that's 1.1. They've probably, I don't know without looking at the actual filing, but I would guess that on that they would have already had a provision of $250 million or something. So the actual gross number is much larger. You're seeing a net number on accounts receivable. And the question is, how much are you paying versus accounts receivable? Historically, even if they were borrowing some money, if you could get a good buy here, pay here company like America's Car Mart at just the value of its receivables once they're marked down, so the loan book, it actually performs well. I mean, the returns on it over its corporate history are close to 15% on what that portfolio would perform and what the stock would perform if you bought it at that level. So that would mean that often the market cap, you could look, let's see. They don't do this anywhere, but if you look at like the income statement stuff, you can see past market caps. In general, it makes sense for the market cap of the company. The enterprise value would be better, but it's really complicated to calculate enterprise value. But the market cap of the company and the loan book should be pretty close to each other. Now, historically, they weren't. The reason why Car-Mart outperformed over its corporate history is because in general, the stock was underpriced. What happened was that people, you know, which might reflect risk and stuff. Maybe it was a realistic assessment in that if things had been different, it would be in a situation like this. Remember, most of this company's history has been pretty loose interest rates. I mean, it's been around a very long time, but we've had very loose interest rate. We haven't had very tight interest rates for most of this company's history. So even when we go into a 30-year history, we don't necessarily see financial conditions tight enough to like ruin the company. But normally you'd expect for it to perform like other stocks, the market cap and the loan book marked down should be about the same. So if you're saying, should the company be worth more like 1.1 billion or something? Yeah. I mean, what's the market cap on it right now? It's incredibly marked down versus what
million.
The, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, yeah. So what is this? $60 stock is, should it be worth 180? Should it be worth 120? Yeah. I mean, if tomorrow the Fed says interest rates are zero and they're going to stay there and stuff and you get back in that climate, yeah, I could see $180 on the stock. I certainly would see $120. It wouldn't happen overnight because people get set in this mindset and it would take them a while till they start seeing the earnings and everything that would make them feel that way. The caveat on this is I don't think the company's business is nearly as good as it was before. They've put out lots of things trying to explain how it's still pretty good and everything. Basically, what they're saying is we still make the same amount of cash back on every loan. It just takes us longer to get it back. Okay.
Because they extended it. They extended their loans. Remember, didn't they also say they were transitioning to a sales organization?
Yeah, they did. But there was more of that talk under a different executive than the one they have now, who I think a previous thing was more on the credit side, but I actually don't know because he held a position in between too. So I don't know that. So although there's lots of continuity at the company, I don't want to make it sound like there's a radical change, but yeah, they did start saying that. But I think why they started saying that is because they had the experience that everyone else had, which is, they were losing business. Their revenue was going down, because it's too loose. Look, if you think about it, what they're saying, when we see it as a business, we look at it and we go, oh, this is terrible. Why are they doing this? They're losing so much money. This is so dumb. They're talking to us about it this way that we used to put it out and get it all back in 20 months. And now we're putting the same amount of money out, getting paid the same amount back over 40 months. It's, yes, it's not as good as the business used to be, but you know, look, we're doing, it works the same way. It's the same business, right? It sounds like they're talking down to you and stuff, but that's exactly what we're all doing in the stock market. We're all buying the stocks at a Shiller PE of 30 something when we used to all buy them at 15. It takes twice as long to get paid back the money, but we don't mark down the stocks, you know? And so this is not in any, you know, like what we're talking about, generally what we're talking about is not their fault. However, like an insurance company and other things like that, There are times where I think if they insisted that they should grow, there were years, just a few years ago, where I think it would be a mistake. They needed to shrink, basically. Like, they can't assume that they can sell more cars and have more revenue each year because they had competitors who were willing to offer better deals to customers. It wasn't just that they were offering different rates and stuff. What they were doing is basically putting poor and poorer people into better and better cars. And you can always take the customers that way. But, you know, it's hard for them to compete with that. And so their business is basically offering very basic transportation. If someone else is going to offer you a slightly nice car versus a really terrible car, then you're probably going to take that, even if it's a bad deal and you're more likely to default on it and all of those things. And a few years ago, that's what the interest rate climate was and the climate in the country and stuff before COVID. And it got very bad for a period in there. And for much of the last 5 or 6 years, I think it's probably been too loose. That, you know, there may have been weird periods during COVID where it wasn't. But in general, it's been too loose. And some of their competitors are in trouble or going out of business or whatever. So, you know. But yeah, it's, you know, you can see, look at the return on invested capital. You can look at other numbers too, but look, it's a cyclical company.
Mm-hmm. Very.
You know, so what the company is it sells these cars to get the loans on the books, and that's how it makes money over time. But, you know, I guess if you think about it this way, right? Let's say, and they don't really talk about the modifications. They don't like using that word, but some of these things are being modified. And so that's why if you look at the length of the portfolio term, it doesn't always move on the current average balance at the same way that it should if it was that they made the loan under these terms. If you knew that going into that bucket, then and it was never modified, then it should come out the other side in a certain number of months. And actually, it's not doing that quite. And that's because these kinds of loans are always... there's a lot of modifications and stuff, right? So there's some cases where it's just being lengthened for some reason during the time that the loan is being made instead of the car being repossessed. So, but they give you that clearly. They tell you like what it actually is as the portfolio currently exists. They don't just tell you what it was when the loan was made. But if you think about if this company was instead of, say, someone selling cars and stuff like this, I don't know, insuring subprime portfolios that, and the insurance was running for a 40-month term or something, right? So it was that long enough tail on it. You know, that's what would happen. People would get nervous about it, and it would, the stock would, you can look at the stock, but the stock often overreacts to that. The stock amplifies the cycle a lot of times. And so it really reacts. Like, I want to be out of this kind of business. I think it is for investors very marginal to them, and they get scared from it whenever they enter a period that's difficult for the company. So basically, they like these subprime companies only when it's not a tough time for the economy, and then they tend to bail on them. They don't stay as long-term investors. The stock actually was a good stock for long-term investors, and that was mainly because the company used the cash flows that it had and bought back the stock instead of growing its loan book dramatically.
Yeah, but the price has definitely come down since it looks like it peaked in 2021.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing.
So basically,
though,
like when rates started going up.
Yeah, but if you look even at like, do you have 5 years or 2 years or something, it can show you that it can move pretty dramatically in a single year, even in ways that would be surprising. Like last time, if you bought this stock at $60 or something, there's probably times you've, even in this cycle, that you've gone from 60 to close to 90 or something for very little reason. But this is one of the areas in which people would really be feeling it. The other thing too, to be honest, is in depending on the way that it reports and everything, some of this is, sometimes when a company is very I'm not saying that this company's, choosing to do this and it's not something that's baked into the industry and everything, but some businesses and industries and being a public company that does just one thing leads to a lot of transparency and a lot of quick reporting of things that is the same stuff going on in other places that you're just not seeing. And so you can just pretend isn't happening. So you can look at this and think that in subprime auto stuff, it's really tough. But commercial real estate, I don't have to think about because the same things that they're having problems with aren't resulting in actual current period reporting that shows that things are much worse than they used to be and stuff. So you can see how this company's earnings went down a lot, how they changed. And just, I mean, you can read the transcripts and stuff and see all of this stuff about what a hard period they're in. But they're just much more sensitive to the rate things to actually affecting their reported results. But like I said, with the commercial real estate, if you know that there used to be 500 people working in that office that your loan is backing that building, and now there's 200 on an average day, you may not have to actually tell the public that that's the situation and that your business has changed and stuff and talk about it the way that Car-Mart is, because as long as they keep making payments on it, you know, you can not deal with that for a while, right? Or as long as you keep getting an appraisal of it, or there's a sale somewhere that's somewhat comparable and stuff, you can tell yourself that, you know, that's not what the situation is. Because this is one kind of thing and it reports through very simply, it's very easy for people to see what the problem is. But I think all their competitors, many of them private, face the same things, and some of them are in worse condition than they are.
Got it. Cool. So somebody had emailed in to me a question, which I liked the individual, and he had said that this is a question that he thinks about often. So he was hoping that we could bring it up on the podcast and get your opinion on it. Back when Trump was elected president and cut the corporate tax rates, you had wrote a blog post saying that you didn't think that it was priced into the market. I think basically after you hit send, it started to be priced into the market. So it was a great call. Curious to hear your thoughts. The question that he had asked this individual was, what tax policies do you think Congress will most likely enact to deal with these persistently high trillion-dollar deficits? Can you foresee a national sales tax or something of that magnitude to deal with that situation? To fix the matter, you have to tax the entire base? What policy do you think they will enact? Do you think federal corporate tax rates will increase at some point in the future, even though they don't move the needle on a deficit reduction? So I just wanted to bring it up. We obviously don't talk about politics, but you have had some market calls based on corporate tax rates and what's going to happen. We spoke a lot about the deficits, so just wanted to hear your thoughts. I don't think this is a political person that wrote in this email. I know him personally, and he just told me that he thinks about this a lot as it relates to valuations in the market and how that could affect it. So do you have any general thoughts on that, corporate tax rates?
Yeah, I think they'll go up. Yeah. And, what raises revenue and stuff isn't necessarily, you know, if you're asking, like, will they tax cigarettes more states and stuff? Yeah, probably. Will it help them or, you know? No, I mean, politically, should be easier to raise rates on corporations than it is to do things like sales tax. Sales tax, national sales tax in the United States would be very difficult. Doesn't mean it won't happen, but it would be very difficult. There's sales tax in lots of states that's a state tax and stuff. And so adopting VAT and sales and all that would really be a problem. And it becomes more of a problem if you already have inflation and stuff. So you wouldn't necessarily want to do that, even if that's the right thing to do, which it may be. I mean, if lowering consumption may be a better thing to do when you have a deficit and want to fix problems than say corporate rates or something. But yeah, sure. Corporate taxes, capital gains and things. I expect, you know, a lot of those things would probably be changed. But as we said, there's no effort by just about anyone to do anything about the deficit. And there was more effort when there was almost a balanced budget at times in the past. So there's not necessarily a very close relationship. If you look from, say, 1940s, 1960s, 1980s, 2000 today, there's not a very close relationship between maybe the deficit and what maybe should be done about it, and debt too. It's not just the deficit, it's the total amount of debt you already have, versus what people are actually going to do. So what's politically possible to work out and stuff. You know, my thing always with the political stuff is, look, the ones that really matter in a country like the United States or some of these other ones is, what's the consensus thing? If we look at what basically do both some Democrats and some Republicans kind of okay with as an idea, that's what matters longer term, of what's considered reasonable, that zone of what those people will consider and talk about as possible places for compromise or whatever. And I don't think it matters as much if you have policies that one party has no one supporting. Because the issue with that is you can put them in, but then they can be immediately reversed. There's courts in this country, there's executives, there's two houses of Congress. It's not realistic to implement things. Look at Obamacare or whatever. Like, it gets put in by mostly one party with a little support, and then it gets whittled down. But even as it gets whittled down, what's left will always be the things that some people on both sides kind of are okay agreeing to. That's true with Social Security things or with health things or whatever. You don't need a lot of it, but you need some consensus things on what's kind of acceptable. It's very hard on some other things that people think will change to actually change and be lasting changes because there's no support from another party. So I doubt that one election completely throws it in one direction or the other, right? But there was pretty wide acceptance by both parties that it was okay to have 50% corporate tax rates after World War II, not that long after that. So yeah, could you have 35%, 50%? Sure, it's possible one day. Buffett's talked about that. He says, look, you own the B shares. The government always owns the A shares. They get to decide how much they own, and they get to take that amount, and they can adjust up or down their ownership anytime they want. I mean, we look at companies in the United States or something and say that they're completely privately owned. They're not. They're 20% owned by the government, because the federal government, because they collect the tax on it. On an economic interest basis, they do, and they can change the law on that. And that's the world that you live in, and so that could happen. You're always subject to the possibility of that dilution, although sometimes they reverse it and gone the other way. Sure. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Got it. Cool. Good answer. That's, I think, our one and only for the year on politics, especially in 2024.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I want to thank so much for tuning in with the both of us on the Focus Compounding Podcast. If this is the first time you're joining us, be sure to hit the subscribe button wherever you are listening or watching us here today. If you're interested in learning about our money management services, you can reach out to me at andrew@focuscompounding.com. or go to our website, Focus Compounding, and click that Invest With Us tab to get all the information you will want on that. I want to thank everybody so much for all the support, and we will see you in the next podcast. Take care.